Hello again, and welcome back for the final time this series to The Gilded Thread with me, Irene O'Brien. So yes, this is episode 6 of my podcast series, in which I've been chatting with my colourful, brilliant guests about their personal and professional lives, as recalled through their memories of style and clothing, and I have been having a ball doing it. So thank you for listening, as always. Like, literally, since the first episode, you've all been listening to the podcast, sharing it, sending messages, and it's meant so much to me. So really, massive appreciation to all of you. It really, really does mean a lot. And while I'm on thank yous, a massive high five of gratitude to Jamie and Alan in Headstuff for supporting me, this like vintage loving Luddite. I just do my thing, send them notes, and they somehow make it possible for you to listen. So big thanks to them, truly, guys. Now, to this episode, it's a case of last but definitely not least, as I got to sit down with Deirdre Macken, owner of the much-loved Shay She in Dublin's Temple Bar, who's been in the business of vintage for over 30 years. Anyone that's ever passed through Temple Bar will know that great, big, happy pink building that's now home to Lucy's Lounge and has welcomed so many designers and creatives through the doors over the years and has homed so many different businesses. At times, chatting to Dee, I actually completely forgot that I was recording because she shares her story with such warmth and ease. And I just felt like I was speaking to an old friend. And she told me about growing up in the Liberties, sharing her shopping trips with her mom, which just sounded amazing. How becoming a new romantic sparked the desire to customize her clothing. She remembers setting up her first ever stall, which I believe was a broom cupboard, and recalls the many chapters she has had in business to bring her where she is today. And thrillingly for me, it was all recorded in the space that was once my favourite haunt. Anyone in the noughties that will have gone there too will agree. Cafe Irie was just the place to go. It's now a brilliantly bonkers Airbnb space, and I just didn't want to leave. Enjoy the conversation, guys. So, Dee, we are sitting upstairs in, would you call it the Shay She building? Do you still call it that?
Yeah, yeah.
In what was Cafe Irie, which is one of the places that I have the best memories of. When I went to college in Ballyfermot, I used to get off the bus at the Quays and often stop in here and come upstairs for some of that beautiful fresh food. And I loved sitting by the window and watching the world go around. And, you know, it was one of the first times that I ever enjoyed a space like that and felt comfortable enough to sit there, and there was a lovely welcome and everything. And over the years, I've just loved coming in here and kind of watching you from afar. And the space, I think, is so representative of you. It's colourful and it's embraces individuality. And I suppose I really wanted to know more about the person that can not only create a space like that, but maintain it for all these years so lovingly and have so many loyal customers and people that kind of come here for a little bit of magic. Yeah. So I'm thrilled that you would speak to me today. Thank you so much.
Lovely introduction.
Well, that's how I feel about it. And I suppose, like, ahead of this, I've always been interested whenever I've heard any of the, well, it's the one building, but any of the kind of different areas of it mentioned and what happens here. But I really wanted to hear about the person, and particularly the younger person, that had such a spark that wanted to pursue this colourful way of life. So tell me a little bit first. I know I was just asking there about, do you call the building Shay She?
Yeah.
This building you have been in for 30 years?
30 years. Let me see. 25 years here.
For 25 years. Mm-hmm. And the business itself
is 31 years this year.
It's 31 years this year. So you would have been one of the first people trading in vintage in Dublin.
Well, when I left school when I was 17, and I started in Mary Street Arcade, which was across the bridge. Mm-hmm. So that would be 36 years ago. And at the time, wasn't called vintage. It was just secondhand clothes.
Yes.
And there was different groups. So then there was mods, there was rockers, there was punks, there was new romantics, which I was. And there wasn't really a lot of people selling secondhand clothes in that way, catering for those kind of groups of people. So when I used to go to the Afro Spot, which was a nightclub off Fleet Street, and I would go to Bartley Dunn's and the Pygmalion places.
Where were they?
So Bartley Dunn's was, Gonnie, on Stephen Street. I'm trying to think who, I don't know who, there's, I think there's like, I'm so out of tune now with pubs and things. But the Hairy Lemon was the Pig Maiden, so Bartley Dunn's was opposite it.
Okay.
And people were used to dress up outrageously there and then go on to the Afro Spot afterwards. So I just decided when I left school that I wanted to sell the secondhand clothes, and I got a space in Mary Street Arcade. I had to beg the guy to let me have the stall. And I left 6 months later and got a shop on the the quays just at the Hapenny Bridge. And he was asking me to come back because I was bringing so many people into the market. And I loved it. I loved it from day one. I love clothes and I still do love clothes.
So thinking of little Deirdre.
Yeah.
When do you remember, is there any moment that you remember thinking, wow, those clothes, I'm able to express myself, or that she really found herself in clothing or fashion or style?
I think when I was an only child.
Okay.
And when I was young, when I was a kid, my mother would buy me clothes every week. My mother loved clothes.
Really?
And we lived in the Liberties. So there was two designer boutiques there, one called the Young Ones, one called the Little Folks. And for special occasions like birthdays, Christmas, if we were going on summer holiday, she'd buy me designer clothes. But on the rest of the week, we would go everywhere shopping for clothes. And at the time, there was the Liberty Market, there was the Dublin Bazaar. There was a man called John Sweeney who had numerous shops around Thomas Street and Meath Street. And we would go hunting for clothes. And it was great. We both loved it. And for some reason, I always knew what was going to come into fashion next.
Really?
So I remember one particular time telling my mother I wanted a tweed suit. And at the time, tweed was not fashionable at all. And it was coming up to Easter. I always got a suit for Easter and I wanted this tweed suit, and I had to walk the legs off her to get the tweed suit. And we went everywhere, Arnott's, Cleary's. And we cut Roach's stores. So in the end, John Sweeney got one from London for me.
Oh, wow.
And then I think, I don't know, I must have been about 10 or 11. And I just realised, how do I always know? Because then the next season, tweed came into fashion.
Yeah.
How do I always know what's going? It was just uncanny. I remember another time I wanted an Air Force blue. Now, how did that colour come into my head? But it had to be a particular kind of grey blue suit. And me and my mother went trundling. But it was great fun and adventure, and we'd have lunch out together, and it was a great bonding time.
Incredible memories. Yeah. And also, you know, considering obviously she loved clothes, she loved dressing you, there's many a young girl that would kind of eventually have rallied against it and said, ah, go on, I'm not into it. It's so lovely that the two of you got to do that together.
That did happen.
Well, eventually, as a teenager, was it?
I think when I was 13, I decided I was going to be a new romantic. Punk had kind of, maybe 15. I didn't really like punk. It was very male. It was too aggressive. But I really loved new romantic. Mm-hmm. It was so, you dressed up, you used your imagination. It was a much softer kind of experience. And my poor mother, it really was when I became separate from my mother. And I think she never got over it, you know.
No.
She hated the clothes.
Oh, did she?
She'd say, please don't wear those clothes. Because on my way home from school, I would walk up Francis Street and I'd go into the Ivy Market and buy the clothes there. And she'd say, how can you just wear those clothes? And every week you'd have to have something different. And it was quite competitive. Everybody was dressing up and everybody was wearing their different styles. And you'd see what your friends was wearing on the night, and you'd spent the whole week just preparing your outfit, you know.
But you know, I don't know that in recent decades there's been that kind of tribalism in dressing that there was there. Do you think there has been?
I think at the moment mainstream, you see, everything is accepted now. Every, you know, before, if I was walking down the street as a 15-year-old, you'd get, somebody would hit you, someone would spit at you, people would shout at you. You had so much abuse hurled at you. Now you can do what you want when you want, and it's much more accepting. And I do think, I find in the shop, because the clothes, I always say I sell for peacocks, people who really want to dress up and express themselves. So I find there are a lot of people who will dress up and wear their own style, but they're kind of, there's less now, and it's kind of because everything is accepted, you don't really notice that.
So do you think that it has become a little bit more homogenised, that everyone's looking like each other a little bit more, or do you just think that we just don't notice anymore because it's a kaleidoscope?
Yes, I think we don't notice. Yeah. Like, even on Saturday, I had two students, they've just, customers who were in school and now they're in college, and they just looked amazing, really originally dressed. And there's other girls who come in, and I just love when I see them coming down the stairs to see how they've put their clothes together. Yeah. So I think there's always, I mean, even if you go back centuries ago, there's always people who wanted to dress up and express their art through how they wear, and it is an expression of self, isn't it, which I think
is amazing. So I think that's really funny then. Your mom was probably like, oh, I obviously instilled too much in her about the expression. You know, when you were talking about getting into the New Romantics, like, can you remember your first memories around that time? Like, what got you into that?
Well, I used to go to a club called The Apartment, which was like a teenage disco, and it was on Fleet Street as well. So you started in The Apartment and then you went on to the Afro Spot. But that was from 8 o'clock till, say, 11 o'clock at night. And on a Wednesday night was when people really, really dressed up. And it just started slowly. I remember being loving Adam and the Ants and that pirate style. Yeah. And that was, I think, I bought a pair of stripy trousers and cut them up to be breeches and put frills on a blouse. And, you know, I thought I was the bee's knees. And
I bet you were. That's exactly the style I think of when I think about what you're speaking of. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just the music at the time. It was the time of, you were influenced by the music. And when you would go into this club, you had all your friends. I mean, we never bothered about boys because we were just looking at what we were all wearing. Yeah. If the boy was dressed up, he was, you know, it was just, I remember one girl came into the club, Natalie. She ended up, I didn't even know her, she ended up becoming my best friend. And she had a piece of yellow fur, like one sleeve on it and one sleeve off. And that was her outfit. And we just would pick a theme. And you'd pick a theme for the week. I did home economics and I sat beside a girl who was brilliant at sewing. And my teacher was really good. She'd let us make the clothes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'd say, okay, this week I am influenced by... So, you know, there was this film called Annie Get Your Gun. And you know, she goes to the ball and she has the big coat over her and she has the beautiful dress. So I wanted to be Annie with the ugly looking coat, and then you take it off and you've got this amazing dress. So the girl beside me made me put all the frills. It was always upcycling, put the frills on the dresses, and I went in the coat. And then those overcoats were a huge style then during the 80s. So you were influenced by everything and anything. You know, you could want to be a military soldier or, I don't know, just anything that came into your mind.
So when you were going to those nights, what were the different kind of tribes, style-wise, that you were witnessing then?
Well, at first it was New Romantics, and then it expanded on to Gothic and Cure and Futuristic. Mm-hmm. So Futuristics were quite minimal and just wore black and just, you know. And then there was Punks, there was Mods. So there was lots of groups of different young people who were into their own independent styles, you know.
Yeah. And were you still at that stage, obviously you had gotten to know so many of the traders and the fashion businesses and shops around the area where you grew up.
Yeah.
Were you still looking to them for some of these styles? Because, you know, you were speaking earlier about what was the man that went and got the tweed?
John Sweeney.
That he sourced that for you. Yeah. Like, he must have gotten a kick out of that too.
Yeah, no, I didn't go back there then. I went to the Ivy Market, and that was on Francis Street, at the bottom of Francis Street, there was, beside the Coombe, there was a big factory.
Mm-hmm.
And they would open one day a week to sell off all their bits of fabric and dresses they had made. And they had, you could call it a vintage section, but it was just old clothes that were in a box. And of course, I would always be stuck in that box.
Yeah.
And as they got to know that I wanted those clothes, they would put more and more out. And then you'd go up Francis Street and there was loads of stalls in the Ivy Market. And you'd go in and... just root through all the clothes and the stuff that you, I mean, if you had the stuff now, you know, you'd love it to bits, but then you just took it for, you'd just get a 1930 bias cut silk fabulous, you know, Hollywood glamorous dress and just cut it up to whatever
know,
you want.
I know, oh my God. That's just the creativity of youth as well, though, you know. And in a way, that's lovely itself. It's just that you just, you
there's
saw,
no reference.
Exactly, and you saw the possibilities with it as well. Yeah. So once you discovered the Ivy Market, that way of shopping and the idea of reusing and upcycling, mm-hmm. was that it forevermore, really? Did you ever go back to traditional shopping? Or?
Well, I think that if you're a designer, you always make classic pieces. So I'm like the shopaholic. I go around all the high street shops. I go around everywhere because I think whoever is designing these clothes will make something that I personally think is a fabulous piece.
Yeah.
So I call them thrift clothes. I don't really buy new, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to buy everything secondhand, but I do buy a lot of things that are just yesterday's fashions and change them around if I want or wear them as they are. You know?
Yeah. So, and always with a view. Yeah, or some. Okay, so you do wear some the way they are as well.
Yeah.
So I always think of you and anything about you, any style I've ever seen as well. It can be something that you might have seen before, but you always have a little extra magic to it, you know? And is that the way you view things? With I suppose with that, what we were talking about earlier, the possibilities of a garment.
Well, I think for me, I don't see reverence in anything. And mm-hmm. I love that. I love that I was taught that very young.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people I find want to be respectable. And I do respect rules, let's say, that are right, but I question everything.
Yeah.
And I see that as a gift from the age I grew up in. I don't accept that if the rule is not right, I'm not going to follow it.
Yeah.
And I don't need to have that respectability. I don't wear jewellery. I don't wear designer labels. I don't need a big car. I just think, does it suit me? And if it doesn't suit me, well then. You know, and I that makes me a very awkward person to be friends with because I just don't want to. It's not that I don't want to follow the flow, but if I don't agree with it, then I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, does that kind of present a quandary in your own mind then when you're talking about, let's say, maybe getting something from last season? Like, will the provenance of that affect how you feel about it if it's something that maybe has questionable provenance where it was made or anything like that? Or do you think it's made now, let's honour it by creating something else?
So the two questions, I suppose, is fur, which is number one. I think if that animal, I don't buy new fur. I love animals. I've 3 rescue dogs in the shop, and I don't agree with killing animals for fur. But if the animal has died, I want to respect its life. Mm-hmm. I don't go out to buy fur, but sometimes it does end up in the shop with the vast amount of stuff I get. And I think, well, I have to respect that animal has died, sadly. Mm-hmm. And the same with, you know, people say about buying things in countries, you know, in poorer countries and the women are under terrible
conditions. You know,
yeah, terrible conditions. And I think that is our fault for wanting fast fashion.
Yeah.
How can you go into a shop and spend €3 on something that's made and expect somebody to get a decent
mm-hmm.
wage?
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to us to change and buy less and pay a better price for things so people will get a good price. But on the other side of it, that girl or that man who's making those clothes, they may have nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
It may be either get that money from those horrendous circumstances they're working in and live, or, you know, working in a factory is sometimes one step in those factories is one step up for some people.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I suppose it's that we all need to demand more from those who we are supporting, and we're supporting them with our wallet and we're supporting them on social media. People are showing all the clothes and everything. I suppose for me, I always think, there's no such thing as cheap fashion. There's always going to be a cost, you know. So I suppose it's that we start questioning it, and that people will then hold, the businesses will hold themselves to higher standards as well. But I do think, like, I have a real thing, because I know, like, at the end of the day, I'm not saying that people should go out and spend loads on every item, like, because people have varying degrees of, you know, income and it's really important that you don't just make this blanket statement like that.
Yeah.
However, what I do say is, whatever you're going to spend and wherever you're going to buy, love it before you buy it. Just love it. Because then you know yourself, you'll care for it, you'll appreciate it. It won't be just thrown away afterwards, you know? Like, I know people that buy stuff for holidays and they're like, should we just leave it behind now? I and I just don't understand it, you know? But anyway, I don't. We could go down a whole other avenue, but I'm just interested for your take on that, you know?
And I do think you can't judge anyone. You don't know people's circumstances. You don't know what way it is. But I think it's the way we think about everything. Is we're living in a throwaway society.
And I suppose there's so much brilliant about social media, but there is, you know, there are people that are followed to see a new outfit on them every day. So what, you know, everything is the result of demand, you know, so it's an interesting one. But then again, like, I love following people that are wearing the same things but differently and styling it differently, or upcycling or doing something. So I suppose you probably get to come across those people so much in your life. So before, because I'm going to talk about those customers, but before we do, you're talking, so it wasn't that long really after kind of the Ivy Market and the stalls and that factory that you were shopping in that the idea started maybe
to have a stall.
To have a stall yourself. So how, I mean, you said that you went up and you asked for the stall, but like, was that something that had been in your head for a long time? Was it an impulsive decision or what? How did that
I lived in the Liberties and where I lived at the time, you couldn't get a job. So I had got a job in a restaurant, and when the manager came back, I was good at my job, I did well, and I had customers giving me good tips and all that. But when the manager came back, she said, oh, you know, you could say this at that time, we can't have someone with your address working here, you know. So she wouldn't. So it was very, you had to give another address rather than say where you lived back then. So I decided, what can I do? What am I going to do? At the time, the art college had opened, but I didn't want to ask my parents to pay for me because you had to pay to go to college. And I thought, well, why don't I start selling these clothes? And so really when it was like I had left school, and after that experience, I got the job in the restaurant, and then after that experience, I didn't want to humiliate myself again. So I said, okay, I'll set up this stall in, and Mary Street Arcade was the place. And the man was lovely, Mr. Cohn. He was horrible to me at the start, but he ended up being lovely. And he'd say, no, 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 we don't want secondhand clothes in here. We don't want this, we don't want that. And then he said, okay. And I think he thought he was being funny. So there was a broom cupboard that he rented to me for £60 a week.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, £60 a week. And he said, you can have this. So you could only fit three rails in it. So I had to put the three rails in at night time. And in the daytime, I'd pull them out. And as I said, after six months or something like that, I decided to leave to get the shop on Haitley Bridge. And he said... he came around to me and said, would you not keep the stall and have two shops and stay there? But I didn't want to. I loved what I did. I wanted to be there present with clothes. And but he was very he was very kind to me when he seen that it wasn't just about selling rags. I washed the clothes, ironed the clothes, presented the clothes. And he would give me little tips on how to do my business.
Well, it sounds like you endeared yourself to him, you know. And also, like, I think he sounds like, the way you describe him, like a kind of a gruff businessman, that actually, you know what, probably then really admired your tenacity and your business brain and the appreciation you had for that as well. So I love relationships like that. Yeah. I love when someone starts off really grumpy and then you kind of know that actually they're fond of you.
And I think as well, I was quite very, very innocent person, innocent young girl. And I think that kind of more so than anything, I don't think I had a business brain. I just think I loved the clothes. And I think he could see that, you know, well, maybe we'll give her a chance.
But, you know, there's, as you know yourself, there's so many types of businesses. And if you make it work, you obviously have had, you know, kind of the acumen for that. I'm really intrigued as to where you sourced the clothes, because you identified that there was a gap in the market because you couldn't find the clothes that you wanted.
Yeah.
So you started selling them.
Yeah.
But how did you know where to source them?
Well, at the time in Dublin, so you have to go back 36 years to Dublin, which was, there was so many empty buildings. Everyone was immigrating out of Ireland. There was nothing happening. There was that one disco, one club to go to, and that was it. You know, there was nothing happening. So there was a lot of people selling secondhand clothes. So there was a market in the fruit and vegetable market, the Daisy Market, there was the Ivy Market, there was Cumberland Street, The Hill, and there was various little shops all around the place with people who would have done it, you know, years ago, and they were older people. And there was people who would collect clothes for sailor works and things like that. And I just got to know so many people, and they would call me and say, you know, do you want to come and have a look at the clothes and buy? And there was a lot of, like, vintage clothes then. It's harder to get vintage clothes now, but very easily.
So did those traders didn't want to sell those clothes themselves, or they were happy, they didn't want on their store, but they wanted to sell to you?
Well, they would sell to me at a discounted price, and then I could get a higher price, because I was buying, say, a raw product, and I was washing it, ironing it, maybe embellishing it a little bit, sending it to the dry cleaners, whatever, and presenting it as something else, whereas they were piling them up and selling them.
Okay, yeah. So really you didn't have anyone, any competitors doing what you were doing at that time?
Yeah, there was no, I'm trying to think if there was, I think there was a few shops, because Dandelion Market had closed down.
Yeah.
So there was a few shops around, but I was doing it in my way. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what I love about secondhand clothes and vintage clothes, is everybody does it in their own particular way. So it's like walking down Grafton Street and seeing all the different shops, and they're all different. It's the same vintage clothes. If there was five vintage clothes shops beside one another, everyone does it in their own personality.
Yeah, they do. And I suppose the difference was, so you, those clothes were available, but only to someone like you who was willing to root and have vision and do all of that. Whereas when you were selling it, you were selling it ready to wear, I suppose, at that stage. So that's where your offering differed. So you moved on from the first market store. Why did you move that time? You wanted to be out of the broom cupboard.
I wanted to be out of the broom cupboard. Well, the shop was beautiful. It was absolutely stunning shop on between the Hateney Bridge and O'Connell Street.
Yeah.
And it had a big, big window. And it was just the most beautiful shop you could see.
Had you been looking for a location where
it just
came in?
I don't know why I wanted to move out at the arcade. I did like it there, and everyone was lovely there, but it was quite pokey.
Yeah.
You know? So having this, it kind of was like going from sharing your bedroom with your sisters to having your own room, that type of thing. And also at night times, I used to have parties in the shop for my friend was the window dresser in McBurney's, which was where Super Value is on O'Connell Bridge there. So we'd be waving over at one another. And then at night time, we'd say once a month or something, we'd have little parties in the shop. So it became kind of a scene, you know.
Yeah, I want to go there.
It was great. It actually was great. And I loved it. It was a very small scene. But I only had the shop for about a year, because the guy I was renting off wasn't paying the rent to the landlord. So in the end, we had to be asked to leave.
Oh, you were subletting. Yeah, okay. Yeah, what else was in that building then?
Well, it was actually a market. And the guy, again, he was a very nice man, but he just, I don't know, he got into difficulties. And it was a market, but the market didn't work for him. Mm-hmm. And he still had the lease on it. So he rented the space to me. But it was beautiful. Big, huge window, old kind of Victorian doors, beautiful, big, wide. Like, it would be preserved now. It's been pulled down, the building. I think it's a church or something at the moment. Okay. So it was, and was steps up to it. And
do you remember the excitement of the first day?
Oh, yeah. I loved it. I really, my father painted it pink.
Oh, wow.
For me.
Pink's been a theme.
Yeah, it's been a theme all my life. And it was just lovely to have this big, huge space. And, you know, everyone came for the first party we had. Everybody came and dressed up, and I remember one guy came with a walking stick, a friend of mine, David Bagnall. He used to always wear dinner suits the time, different versions, and he had a beautiful midnight blue dinner suit with a walking stick. And it was a good night.
Were your family very proud of you?
Well, I don't know. My mother wanted me. My best friend got a job and worked in Guinness. Mm-hmm. And my mother would have loved me to just do that.
Yeah.
Be a secretary in a big company somewhere. Because, you know, this was the unknown.
Yeah.
This was, and I think when I started up my stall, the first day I came home, and they were all sitting around the table. And so I lived with my uncles, my granny and my mother and father.
Oh, wow.
So everyone was sitting at the table and I came home. They said, how did you do today? And I had made 3 pounds. And they said, well, that's good. You know, you're going to do fine. Keep doing it and see what happens. And then the next day I came home and they said to me, how did you do today? And I said, I made 60 pounds. And they nearly
died. Oh, you made your rent for
the
week.
I made the rent on the Saturday. And they were thrilled. They were absolutely thrilled.
They must have been buzzing for you. Yeah.
So my mother used to wash the clothes. We had a twin tub. She used to wash the clothes. My father did all the repairs and the deliveries. And my uncle used to come and help me in the stall sometimes, sit there if I had to go somewhere.
That's amazing. Yeah. God, talk about it takes a village to start a business.
Yeah, that's
so cool. And you know, I don't want to keep on jumping, but I'm just struck, you were just saying there about kind of growing up in the Liberties and how a lot of people were moving away and how, of course, your mom would have loved kind of some more security for you. When was it quite unusual then what you did going off into your own business then? Was it either that people were leaving or getting secure jobs or what was the norm?
I think it was really unusual to set up your own business. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, even my friends, would say, are you a bit mad doing this? Would you not try and get a job? Would you not go to college? And because everyone did secretarial courses and get, but I couldn't have, I didn't want to work in an office. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been able to work in an office. And everyone had to give the false address from my area. I didn't want to do that. I was quite principled about it, you know.
Isn't that extraordinary to think that that was like what era was that? The '80s.
That was the '80s. I left school in 1982.
That just blows my mind that was happening then. You know, and also because the thing that strikes me about the Liberties is such a sense of community and people are so proud of where they're from and everything, and it feels so wrong. I'm in awe of the route you took to overcome that as well. You know, what did you name the shop down in it was Bachelor's Walk?
It was Let Them Stare.
Let Them Stare. God, that's perfect.
Yeah,
is that what you would call the stall as well, or did the stall not have
stall
a name?
Was Let Them Stare. Everything was Let Them Stare. And but I left it there. After that I left and I went to London like everybody else. And I lived in London for about 4 years and I still sold. For the first year, I didn't sell secondhand clothes. I worked in a bar and then I started doing the market. So I did Portobello and Camden. I lived on East Street Market, so I used to sell there as well. And that was perfect for me because I met so many people and got loads of contacts and, you know.
How did it differ from here?
Well, Dublin was like a little village and it was very, very conservative and, you know, nobody minded their own business. You know, everyone, you'd sit on the bus and a woman would come up to you and say, the state of you wearing them clothes, you know. Whereas in London, you could be who you wanted to be and nobody ever said anything to you. And there was so many clubs to go to and you were kind of applauded for being a little bit different, you know.
So did you at any stage find it intimidating or did you just embrace the freedom from early on?
I did find London intimidating because I went by myself. Mm-hmm. So and I had friends over there, but I was living by myself in Baker Street. But, you know, you just get on. It's like anything. Sometimes intimidating is good because you've got to, you
feel the fear and do it anyway.
But again, I think I've been really lucky in my life. I've always met people who've been very kind to me. And doing the stall in Camden, I did it in Camden Ballroom. I think it's gone now. And like people were really nice. The other stall holders were friendly. So you immediately went into a little scene, you know.
What styles in fashion stand out in your mind that you were maybe introduced to there that you hadn't come across yet in Dublin?
Well, definitely the young designers over there. Mm-hmm. So at the time I went, Margaret Thatcher was in power and she really was for educating people. Mm-hmm. And there was loads of free courses and people weren't paying to go to college. Mm-hmm. So there was loads and loads of young designers. And Portobello Market and Camden, they were just full of young people selling their own things. Mm-hmm. And it was a great time of just, you know, finding all these people who had such creativity. Mm. You know?
So was that the first time you had ever experienced people being encouraged to pursue their art?
Yes. So when I went to London then, I started doing different courses on how to start your own business.
Oh, wow.
And it really did cater. So you'd have, say you wanted to start a business and you wanted to sell sweets. You'd have someone who would actually cater for sweets. It wasn't a generic course. Mm-hmm. And say, I wanted to do, you know, how to be a painter, a decorator. It would be specifically for that. I think she wanted to encourage people to be, you know, entrepreneurs. There was a great spirit of set up your own business and do your own thing.
So really, completely the opposite of what you had been experiencing in Dublin.
Yeah, because in Dublin, you couldn't get a lend from a bank. Mm-hmm. You know, I can understand why people were saying it. Don't set up your business. Oh my God, how are you going to do that? Because, you know, there was nothing happening here, you know?
Yeah.
It was very depressed, you know?
What was your biggest takeaway from that time? So it was 4 years you were in London.
Yeah, in London. Well, I think that thing you said, feel the fear and do it. Anyhow, I became a bit more courageous, a bit more independent from my family. And I kind of just didn't listen to anyone really. Yeah. If somebody said, don't do it, I thought, well, do I really want to do it or do I not want to do it? I learned, which was actually bad for me, not to take people's advice, because then I did need people's advice, but I kind of, you know, felt like, no, I know, because I had to fight the battle so much to do my own thing.
That became innate then, questioning everything.
Yeah, and then so when I look back on my life, that was something I learned in London. Paddle your own canoe, do your own thing. You will find your tribe. You will do whatever it is you need to do, and it will work. It was like it was magic or something.
Yeah.
But there's always a yin to the positive. Yeah. There's always a bad to the positive. Yeah. You know?
So who were your tribe in London?
Well, I used to go to those, you know, the clubs where people dressed up and wore their own clothes. Mm-hmm. I think clubbing was very important to me. I'd go to Taboo, where Lee Berry was, and go to, there was another one, I think it was the Mud Club or something, around on Charing Cross Road. I'd go to Camden Palace, where, you know, I think it was Steve Strange was on the door there. And I loved all that. There was a place there was Kensington Market in Kensington, where there was all little independent stalls and stall holders that they had small shops there. And then there was Hyper, which was the designer place.
Yeah.
So that kind of became what I really looked up to and loved and felt part of, you know.
The 80s really, particularly in London, it was the era of the club kids, wasn't it?
Yes.
And really, and I don't know, I can't remember what the name of the exhibition was. I went a couple of years ago in London, and it was very much about that and about people creating their own clothes around that time. And then about Vivienne Westwood coming very much coming very much into, oh my God, my brain isn't working. Prominence. Vivienne Westwood coming into prominence as well. And it felt like a very exciting time. They had a lot of imagery of a lot of the clubs and stuff. And it was a sad time as well, because, you know, there was a lot going on with AIDS and everything there as well. And they were talking a lot about that. But it was fascinating. And I think that it must have been a time of great growth in people's personalities, because the experience was, there was new experiences to embrace all of the time.
Yeah.
Why did you make the decision to come back?
Because I'm an only child and my parents missed me and I miss them. I went to London because I wanted nobody to know me, and I came back to Dublin because I wanted somebody to know me.
Yeah, I know.
So it was great to be there and to be kind of almost invisible, you know, when you're walking down the road. But, and also I wanted to set up my own business. I had worked hard in London, saved up enough money and decided to come back here. And I had done all these courses about fashion and clothes and all that. And I just thought, why not come back and live here and see what it's like?
And I suppose you do get an appreciation. Like, I went to London apparently for a couple of weeks and I didn't come back in the late 90s. And it is that, like, I was so excited by the anonymity of it all. But also I realised, do you know what? It doesn't take long for no one to ask where you are or what you're doing. Or the realisation that no one's going to ask where you are or what you're doing. And the thing that I had been running away from, eventually I ran back to coming home, you know, that familiarity. Yeah. And I suppose the thing is, you had lived with so many of your family members and everything as well. It was a support system full of different dynamics, I'm sure, that you missed too. So when you came back, it was always with the intention of opening the business.
Yes. Yeah.
And tell me how that came about then. Did you start that straight away when you came back?
I can't remember how long it was, but I rented a shop in Temple Bar from Paddy Dunning, who owns the Music Centre and various business. So workshop at Ella is on the corner. Yeah. That was my shop from 19. So I started on Friday the 13th of November 1987. And I was, you know, again, I was quite lucky to get that shop because at the time Temple Bar was going to be a, what do you call it, a bus depot.
Yes, yeah, I've heard that before.
And they had really decided to do it, so they weren't giving any short-term lets to anybody. And Paddy had the shop there and he rented it to me and I was his tenant for, I don't know how long, maybe about 20 years or 15 years or
so something. So that's where
like
you
that.
Were, and that's where your first business was. And what was it called at that stage?
I called it Shay She because I had come back. I was the immigrant coming back home and I loved everything Irish. And so I wanted he and she. So it was called Shay She.
And what did you sell in Shay She?
I sold secondhand clothes, ethnic clothes and young designers. Mm-hmm. And it started off very well. I had collected so many clothes from London over the years that I had worn myself and just basically set up the shop with them.
Brought all the stuff back from designers.
London. Yeah, and found young designers.
Found young Irish designers.
Yeah, yeah, who wanted to sell.
Was there anyone doing anything similar at that time?
I'm sure there was. Like, Frank was in Flip Up the Road here.
It was already open.
Yeah, there was Eager Beaver was around the corner and there was Damascus was in Crown Alley. There was Rumours, which was probably one of the first vintage clothes shops in the new Temple Bar. So there was quite a lot of us here selling secondhand clothes and there was other people coming and going.
Yeah,
you know,
because I know when I was younger, that's if anyone thought about secondhand clothes, it would very much be, oh, you go to Temple Bar for that. But I wasn't sure who started it, how it came about, you know. And I suppose was one of the reasons that people were attracted to Temple Bar to set up those businesses, were the rents quite affordable?
The rents were affordable and you could find a place. I mean, again, you were coming back to the same thing. The banks wouldn't lend you money. The estate agents wouldn't answer your calls. You know, nobody was taking you serious. And but in Temple Bar, the guy was Mr. Beer from CIE and he was a lovely man and he rented the shops to all the young businesses.
So what happened about the bus depot?
Well, basically everybody got up in arms who was trading here and decided that we didn't want a bus depot. We wanted this independent trading area in the middle of Dublin city centre. So there was the Projects Art Centre, was the art buildings down here. There was a few pubs and people just got together and fought the fight and they decided, Charlie Huhy got on board and they decided not to do it.
But it does show people power and becoming galvanised.
Yes.
It does. It does make a difference.
Really,
and I think
really
we need
does.
To remember that today as well, you know.
Yeah.
So has there, as a consequence of that, or maybe prior to that, was there always a sense of community within the traders and businesses here?
Yeah, I have to say, I hate the way Temple Bar gets bad publicity because my personal experience is that it's a fabulous area with lovely, lovely people who work and run their own business. Mm-hmm. And if I need anything, I can run around the corner and say, oh, can I borrow this? Or go into my neighbour and say, can I borrow this? Can I get that? And people are very supportive. If something bad happens, you know, they're always there, you know, offering you a shoulder to cry on, or even if something good happens, they rejoice. You know, it really is like a small town within Dublin City.
Yeah. And how has the landscape changed? I don't mean physically, of course, physically it has changed over the years, but how has the business landscape changed? Has there been various chapters in the life of Temple Bar, do you think?
Well, I think the first chapter was when all the small businesses came in and then we decided that we wanted it to be a special area. And then Temple Bar Properties came in and took over. And in a way, they ostracised an awful lot of the small businesses and a lot of them had to move out.
Because what was their aim?
They wanted it to be what it is now, but they kind of, in their way, they came in with big muddy boots and just trampled over a lot of small businesses that were here and who had the vision for it. So, and then they're gone now and it's kind of settled into itself. There's a mixture of small businesses and there is big, like urban outfitters, which are big multinational businesses or different places like that. And we all work together. I mean, there's McDonald's on the street now. So everyone just works together. I mean, I think it's sad that, like, McDonald's...
The conglomerates are in.
Yeah. No, I don't even think... Because I think there's space for everyone in the world, you know. But I do think they have less of a human face.
Yeah.
You know, I asked them the other... A couple of months ago, could I take a photograph of one of the girls wearing a vintage outfit in the McDonald's? And, oh, no, no, you can't do that. Like, what are we going to do? Steal your soul?
Yeah.
You know, you don't have one. You know? Like, and that's, as I said, I think there's space for the big guys and the little guys.
But if they cohabit, like, yeah, in a friendly
manner,
the little
guys won't make space for the little guys.
The bigger guys won't make space for the little guys. How did Shay She work out? So 20 years you were on that corner.
Yeah.
And how did it work for you and how did it evolve?
Well, I started with one shop and I ended up having five shops, and one shop was in London. I went back to London and had a shop in High Street, Kensington.
Wow. How did you get from one to five?
I know. It just happened. So it just, I had an unbelievable group of people around me who were so talented and so creative and so believing the same as what I believed. So I had five people working with me and working very, and I always had great staff. And so we sold the Tree Clothes and then they kind of started to expand. So Shay She, which was Shop at Ella, original we called that, that was the second hand. And then I had another shop that sold ethnic clothes. And then I
opened, in Temple Bar?
In Temple Bar. And then I opened the shop here, which was Shay She Progressive, which sold young designer labels. And then I had a sales shop around the corner as well. And then the shop in London.
So all in Temple Bar and then
four
one for London.
And one in London. I had one shop off Grafton Street for a very short while, but mainly Temple Bar. It was just easier to run around between them.
And how do you manage it? You must really actually feel an affiliation with Ella and the way she has progressed then with her shops too. What, how did you manage it all?
Well, as I said, I had brilliant people. Mm. I had people who just loved what they did. And I don't know. I didn't have a life, I suppose.
Yeah.
I just constantly worked.
It was an extension of yourself, the businesses.
Yeah.
And at what stage did it... Because eventually it all became here in this building.
In this building.
Is it three-story or four-story?
Is
it more?
I think it's four-story.
Four-story.
Yeah.
Everyone will know this. You know, it's pink and bright and beautiful building. You see people just even taking photos outside all the time and everything. There's an energy around this shop. And that's where we are now. So in the basement, it's Lucy's Lounge.
Yeah.
And the ground floor?
So when I bought this building in 1992... And at the time, I was pregnant with my son. So when I went to the banks, I went to every single bank and they wouldn't lend me the money. And eventually, I went to Smurfit and met a really nice man who had lived in, was reared in Temple Bar and could kind of see what I seen. Because at that time, Temple Bar wasn't what it is now. So.
Yeah.
But because I was pregnant, I used to have to kind of put like something on my belly to shrink it down so they wouldn't know that I was pregnant. Because that was another added negative. Not only that you were this person wearing crazy clothes, going and looking for money and, you know, saying, oh, I'm selling secondhand clothes. You know,
they just didn't get it.
So I spent the whole year crying because I'd go to meetings and be told maybe and then be told no, no, no. And eventually this man from Smurfit gave me the money to buy the building. And the idea for the building was that you could walk in as an office worker with your suit and you could walk out as a completely different person because you could get your hair done, you could get pierced, you could get tattoo, you could have coffee in the cafe, you could buy the clothes.
So it was a destination like no other.
It was like an alternative department store.
Wow.
Yeah.
And had you closed all the other businesses at that stage when you were
trying? No, they were all gone.
But you were trying to merge them into one space.
Well, no, what happened was because Temple Bar was being redeveloped, I was getting short-term leases. So all the leases were up. So the shop where the ethnic clothes were, that's now the burger place down there. The shop, which was the sales shop, that's now a music shop.
Mm-hmm.
I did stay with Paddy there and Yeah, and then I did this here. So, and I couldn't keep, because I was having a baby, I couldn't keep the shop in London mm-hmm. on, because I was going every weekend over to London.
It wasn't sustainable.
And we were also doing club nights in the pod or in
Of course you were. She had so much time in your hands. Were you doing club nights in the kitchen?
We were doing club nights in the kitchen. And
what kind of nights?
So it was just different, again, different DJs. We'd have Billy Scurry or different DJs come in and do their music.
Yeah.
And then we'd have the best dressed person.
Oh, amazing. Who's and, we? Yeah. You keep on saying we. Suddenly the there's a worked, time now that, so yeah, the people, so the people so that the people worked for you.
Then there was five girls, all girls, I don't know why, but it was really girl power. Yeah. And one girl called Barbara Burke, she ran the nightclub, and she also set up, we were upcycling clothes, mm-hmm. so she would do that. There was another girl, Jacqueline, who was the manager of everything.
Okay.
There was Dan Deline, who just loved the vintage and looked after
she's one of my
vintage.
Style icons.
Yeah, and she's still here. And there was a girl called Jenny who ran the new clothes. And then there was people like Ali Carey and other people who came. Ali did like the press and things
okay,
like that.
Yeah.
And we were always getting mentions in the press.
Yeah. So. Well, it was completely unique. There was nothing like what you had here.
Yeah.
So the day you opened your doors here, what was on each level?
So when we opened first, it was me on the ground floor doing the designer clothes. And it kind of evolved over a period of time because the building wasn't in good condition. So we had to redo the building. And then it went in the basement. There was a hairdresser's. There was a record shop.
Mm-hmm.
There was Peekaboo clothing, which was, you know, clothes made from scratch.
Yeah.
Designer label. On the first floor, there was, before Cafe Ari, there was a cafe, Glenn Hansard. And his friend... And I can't remember his name. I don't know. He was here anyhow doing a vegetarian cafe.
Oh, cool.
And then on the top floor, there was Paddy the Piercer. He did piercing. And there was Karen Russell, who was the first female tattooist
in
Dublin.
Paddy the Piercer. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's the greatest name of all time. So they were doing that. And was there just a great feeling of excitement amongst you all? Like community within a building then?
I hope there was.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I hope there was. There was certain things were a problem because we were all sharing the electricity. So sometimes you'd be in the middle of doing something, the electricity would go. But everybody who was here has moved on to do something bigger and better, let's say.
Yeah.
So it was quite exciting times and times of kind of innocence, really, because we didn't really know what we were doing. And we had parties in the building as well, where, you know, the Gardaí would come and say, you can't do that, you know. And the Hirschfield was next door, which was, you know, the first gay club
in
Dublin. So there was kind of this thing going on.
And was there a feeling like in London, was there a connection between kind of the clothes you were selling and the interest that people had, and then them living their lives in the evenings, expressing themselves in that way?
I think there was. I mean, I sold young Irish designers who moved on and did really to big things, like Patrick Sweeney used to sell.
Really?
Here. And my memory has gone from remembering people's names, but there was a lot of the young designers who have moved on, like Claire Garvey. She was telling me the story of when she came in here to sell her clothes and how she was really nervous.
Oh.
And, you know, there was a lot of, it was a place where the young designers and a lot of them who moved on to do really great things started off and gave us their clothes for sale.
They had room to develop here as well. And was that something that you were clearly passionate about?
We were trying to do that. We were trying to really work with young designers and offer them a platform for to sell their clothes.
And are there any designers that would be surprised to know sold here? Like, were they all colourful? And you think of Claire Garvey, it doesn't surprise me at all now that she sold here, you know.
Yeah. I have a few, I don't know, Tim Ryan, Snipwear, you know him in London. He sold here. There was some people who it wasn't always colourful. There was a girl I loved called Maria Azambuka, and she did all these linens and natural fabrics, and she'd put seeds in the clothes. And there was a girl called Helen, who used to do fabulous, beautiful, earthy knitwear.
Mm.
So it was a complete, I mean, the whole ground floor was covered. So there was so many different designers came in.
And how did that move on then to kind of where we are today? So where we are today, Lucy's Lounge is mm-hmm. in the basement. That's your mm-hmm. the mixtures there of, mm-hmm. of pieces. Like what can people expect when they go into Lucy's Lounge?
So I sell vintage clothes. I sell contemporary clothes. I sell trend-led clothes.
And upcycled pieces.
And upcycled as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we usually sell them just in the springtime. I don't know why. It's because they're more lighter fabrics and they're easier to sew.
Yeah.
So we sell them spring right through to autumn, but we don't really do it in the winter time.
And who works with you there now?
So, believe it or not, my husband does all the sewing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he does the sewing. And we did, when the economy went really, really bad, we thought, how can we give back to Dublin, the community of Dublin, who has given us so much? So we, for about 2 years, we did free sewing classes.
Oh, okay.
And we taught, we did it here, actually. After it was a coffee shop, it turned into a studio. And we taught over 100 people to sew.
Amazing.
And a couple of those people now sew for us.
Okay, very
and
good.
A lot of them
came full circle.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of them have gone on to do. I had one girl in, and she's now a burlesque dancer, and she makes her own costumes.
Wow.
Another guy, he was in the other day, and he's with some football club where he repairs all the.
Yeah. Gee, for us talking about one extreme practical. Or the other. Yeah. I know, exactly. So yourself and your husband must really share a vision then.
Not really.
Do you not? So, well, it sounded like all harmony there for a minute.
Yeah, I know. It is my baby very much, but he helps. He stayed at home and reared our children.
Yeah.
So he helps me wherever he can. And he loves, he's very talented at making things and doing things. So that was another adventure for him, was to explore learning how to sew. So he did that for a while. But now he's decided, no, I'm not doing that anymore. I've had enough of it, you know.
What ages are your children?
So I only have two children, 25 and 20.
And what do they think, and what did they think when they were younger of what their mom does?
Well, when my kids were young, they used to say, please just look like the other moms when you come to school.
Because that's what I was thinking. That's all we want when we're younger. And then we really appreciate how cool, you know, kind of being different is.
They hate it. And also, I love finding things on the road. So we'd be driving and then I'd put the brakes on and they'd go. And I lived in the country, so there'd be loads of things in the ditches. And they'd be, please do not. I don't
just
want to
just be normal.
See this.
That's what kids say.
Yeah. But they both are minimal. They will, you know, they both wear very plain clothes. And I showed them photographs of Matty Bovin, who I love, my favourite designer in England at the moment. And I try, and especially the 20-year-old, I'm trying to convince him to discover his inner Matty Bovin, who wears really colourful, fabulous clothes. But no, they just...
Isn't that so funny? Yeah, I always find that really interesting because I think they are...
It's your way of rebelling.
Exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. In a really subtle pared back way. So that's what's happening. And then as we move up the building then, you have your ground floor.
So then it all changed when I had children, I had to stop being a slave to mm-hmm. my ambitions and dreams and be practical. Mm-hmm. So I shrunk the whole business back. And during the Celtic Tiger, people didn't want secondhand clothes. Mm-hmm, so I went out of business for a few years and it was fine. It was grand. My children were growing up. And
so did you rent this space out?
So I rented everything in the building out. And then the bust came again and all the people who were renting from me were able to find shop premises. Mm-hmm. So they all left. And I was left with a nearly empty building to fill up again. So then there was the new people who came in, all the lovely foreign people who mm-hmm. came to Ireland and were looking for spaces to rent. So during the boom or during the bust, everyone left. And all, so on the ground floor, there's people from Lithuania who rented the shop for me. And in the basement, we did like an arcade and there was people from all over the world, Brazilians and Indian selling their wares down there. And then on the first floor, the coffee shop moved out and we tried lots of different things here. We did the sewing workshop, we did different things, but it just didn't work out.
Yeah.
So then Airbnb came along and we do 3 nights Airbnb here and 4 nights using, or 4 days using it as our office workshop.
Yeah,
and all
which
of
is
that.
Why we're so lucky to be chatting in yeah. here today. Well, you're yeah. so lucky every yeah, day, yeah, but yeah, I'm so lucky yeah. now. And I'm looking around and there's hobby horses and just all the colour and the brightness. Yeah. You're sitting in the most amazing chair because obviously where women used to get their hair yeah. set in there as well. And all around it just looks extraordinary. And all these bags here that I know you're going to spend the next couple of days yeah. then going through sort all the pieces as well. So it feels like you've always found really great purpose for each yeah. of the spaces as well. And as I was saying earlier, you know, just my memories of Cafe Irie, literally looking out this window, there was something very magical about Cafe Irie, wasn't yeah. there? What worked about it, do you think?
There was 2 people ran it and they were fabulous. Their belief, I think they were the first of that hipster style yeah. coffee shop.
Yeah.
They believed that the food should be fresh. Mm-hmm. Everything should be fresh, and they had really, really good coffee.
Yeah.
And they have moved on now. They've got a big business, a big cafe out in Skerries.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they've
good.
Got children and they live in that area.
I'll and have to go on a little visit yeah, to yeah, Skerries yeah. now.
They were here for a long time.
A long time.
And they
yeah.
really ran, like you said, fabulous,
yeah.
you know, beautiful, fresh-made relish yeah. on your
And do you
sandwiches.
Know what it was? There's a, it's funny because obviously different people were running different floors, but you very much led a culture by the tone you set, because every floor you'd go into there was a welcome and an inclusivity that you didn't yeah. necessarily get everywhere else
yeah.
and sometimes you know yourself it can be intimidating to walk in somewhere because there were always people hanging around, you know what
yeah,
I mean because
yeah,
obviously
yeah, yeah.
people liked
yeah.
you know got to know people in the area, so sometimes that can be really intimidating and it never felt like that
yeah.
and I think that's a real credit to you
yeah
because you've real natural warmth anyway and
yeah.
welcome here as well
yeah.
so I think that that's lovely. What has been, since that time, since the bust and the boom and everything, and to the point that we're at today, you spoke about the learning curves and the feel the fear and do it anyway
yeah,
in London.
Yeah.
Today, as Deirdre D sits
yeah,
here with
yeah.
me, and looking back over, what is it, 31 years now of Shay Shay, what is the greatest takeaway for you?
I think that I've done what I love every day in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm really, really, really lucky to have done that. And you say that it's friendly. Like, really, I genuinely love people.
Yeah.
And I think everyone who comes in here has that common denominator, that they're curious and they love people. I say that my shop is the inside of a pleasantly disturbed mind. You know?
That's perfect.
My life has been pure indulgence, you know, self-indulgence, just doing what I want to do. My song when I was a teenager was Toya Wilcox, I Want to Be Me, I Want to Be Free.
Yeah.
And I think I've lived by that ethos for my whole life. Like, I think when I came back after during the bust times, Dublin was different. During the boom, people weren't nice.
Yeah.
The reason I left the shop was I was selling something to eat. Very young girl, maybe 15 years of age. It was a 5-year-old top. And she said to me, "You're really trying hard to get that sale. I don't know if I'll give it to you or not."
Oh.
And I felt so hurt and insulted. I wasn't, maybe I was, but I was actually being friendly. And when I went home that night, I said to my husband, "I'm not doing this anymore. Dublin is not nice."
Mm.
And when I came back during the bust, it had changed. People were lovely and people were, you know, there was space for art and space for
mm-hmm.
people to do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved coming back. And I think I was grateful to get a second chance to be in my shop. And Dublin reacted really, really well and supported me. And this year I only open 4 days, Thursday to Sunday, because I'm a little bit older now and I want to do other things. And again, people have reacted and I got such a positive support from
mm-hmm.
I really feel part of Dublin community.
Yeah.
And I do fear now the way Dublin is changing. You see, the flea market is gone, a lot of small businesses are gone. And I do worry that we're taking that personal thing out
mm-hmm.
of Dublin,
yeah.
you know?
Well, I think that that's why this is such a beacon and a gem in the Dublin landscape, and it's such
yeah.
a joy to come to. So I hope that for many, many years into the future it will last. Well, thank you so much for always striving for that, because we all get to enjoy it as well. So best of luck for the future, and thanks for chatting to me.
No problem. Thank you very much.
I loved our chat.
Yes, I sure did.
Love our chat.
Thank you so much to Dee for taking the time not only to have a chat with me, but to bring me up to what was formerly known as Cafe Irie and that beautiful Airbnb space. I absolutely encourage you to go online and try and find pictures of it. It's just the most absurdly brilliant place right in the heart of Temple Bar to stay. And it's just a true reflection and continuation of everything that Dee has done with that building, with that beautiful pink building that holds such special memories for me. And I know today there's people that assist me that still are going and doing work experience there at Lucy's Lounge. So it's just this continual cycle of encouraging creatives and independent thinkers, and of course, massively supporting young designers and people setting up themselves. So thank you so much to her. I really hope you enjoyed that chat. And I loved that as well, because I loved hearing about the Dublin landscapes that she remembers over the years and then how it changed when she came back, because I know so many of my friends have had that experience through different decades, and it's always interesting to hear how people settled and what they brought with them and what they realised they loved about Ireland too. So that's it now. That is the last one, the last episode of the first series of The Gilded Thread. And I have to say, I thought about it for so long and I faffed and I worried and I did nothing and I bought a recorder. No, got given a recorder by my husband. Thank you, Mel. Did nothing, was scared, thought about contacting people, did nothing. But eventually I did, got the ball rolling, and I'm so happy I did, because I have just thoroughly enjoyed these conversations. And I know that many of you have too, because you've made contact and said that, which just means the world, because that's just the icing on the cake. But I do want to sincerely thank all of my guests who were so willing and encouraging and just so giving of their time. So thank you so much to Celia Homan Lee. Thank you so much to my mama bear, Anne O'Brien. Thank you so much to Olivia Tracy, to Louis Copeland, to Rosemary Smith, and of course to Deirdre Macken of Lucy's Lounge as well. Yes, I remember them all and it wasn't even written down. But actually, I'll never forget them, because I've learned something from everyone. And what I really have learned over this series is there is there's great privilege in being able to follow your own dreams and express yourself throughout your life. And I feel very privileged to be doing that in my work. And it has reminded me that that isn't necessarily the way that the route that everybody can take. So I do feel privileged. I feel privileged to have chatted to all of those people. And I feel delighted that you guys have listened. I do plan to record a second series. I'm going to start that kind of mid-November, end of November. If any of you know fabulous, colourful people that have lived brilliant lives that would like to speak to me about their style memories over the decades, I would be thrilled with any suggestions. You can follow me on Irene O'Brien Style on Instagram. And I think that's probably the easiest place. So just DM me there. But thank you, thank you, thank you to all of you for listening. I really, really appreciate it. And if you haven't listened to any of the previous ones in this series, please do go back and have a listen. And of course, any thumbs up or whatever it is on iTunes is obviously always appreciated. But mostly, thank you for listening. I really, really am thrilled. Take care. Till next time. Bye bye.